I've talked to the sister of Larry Jackson Jr. here in Austin, Texas, who was killed, and Larry Jackson Jr. was killed by a police officer in July 2014.
We have 10 seconds.
And after that, I had long conversations with her. I think that what we need to do is offer therapy. That therapy needs to be free. And we also need to be able to do the research that we need in order to know what the extent of this problem. We don't have sufficient data on a national scale to be able to know what's going on. So in order to address this, the families need therapy. They need free therapy. They need support. And they need support from society in a way that they are not going to have to bear the
burden of this. We're going to continue this conversation. Post online at democracynow.org. Professor Kristen Smith, thanks for joining us. Thanks for joining us on Democracy.
Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Events Committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Scanner Foundation's 32nd Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast on Monday, January 15th at 8:30 a.m. at the Red Line Hotel on the River in Portland. This year, Nelson Senior Vice President of U.S. Strategic Community Alliances and Consumer Engagement, Cheryl Grace, will be the keynote speaker. Grace has been with Nelson for 13 years, and for the past 7 years has overseen the production of a report on Black consumers, and we'll speak about the power of the Black dollar. Again, that's the Scanner Foundation's 32nd Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast on Monday, January 15th at 8:30 a.m. at the Red Line Hotel on the River, 909 North Hayden Island Drive in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Bill McKibben coming at you on KBOO Portland, Oregon.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. In his latest attack on immigrants, in particular those from the global south, Donald Trump announced that 200,000 U.S. residents who hail from El Salvador will lose their protective status, the TPS status. Here to fill us in on what that means and what steps Salvadorans can take is Yanira Limus, supervising attorney for Loyola Immigrant Justice Clinic at Loyola Law School, and an update on movements and controversies on the continent of Africa, from Libya to Kenya to Zimbabwe. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. Republican and Democrats involved in negotiations over the must-pass January spending deal say that DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, has become the key to unlocking any funding agreement, and some are frustrated with how negotiations are unfolding. Republicans charge that Democrats have all but halted talks on spending caps until there is a resolution on DACA, which gives undocumented immigrants who came to the country as children a chance to stay, work, or study in the U.S. without fear of deportation. Republican Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona told CNN that border security can be worked out later, and action on DACA is needed now. The meeting at the White House today was expected to, at the very least, symbolize that Trump was growing more serious about finding a bipartisan resolution, but adding more tension to the anticipated meeting for Democrats as the fact the White House invited GOP lawmakers, Democrats' view was openly hostile to finding a consensus deal on DACA. The rival Koreas took steps toward reducing tensions during rare talks today as North Korea agreed to send a delegation to next month's Winter Olympics in South Korea and reopen a military hotline. It was the first meeting of its kind in 2 years. It was arranged after North Korean leader Kim Jong-un made an abrupt push for improved ties with South Korea following a year of elevated tensions with the outside world over his expanding nuclear and missile programs. Critics say Kim may be trying to divide Seoul and Washington in a bid to weaken international pressure and sanctions on the North. Here's CIA Director Mike Pompeo on CBS News' Face the Nation.
He is looking for a foothold to walk himself back. This would be entirely consistent with his historical activity. When he sees the threat, he tries to pacify it. And you can be sure that this administration is not going to fall prey to the same trap that previous administrations did.
During the talks, the North Korean delegation said it would send an Olympic delegation, including officials, athletes, cheerleaders, journalists, and others. South Korea also reportedly suggested resuming temporary reunions of families separated by the Korean War. Syria's military accused Israel of launching missiles targeting its outposts near Damascus in a wave of 3 pre-dawn attacks today and claimed that the Syrian Air Force hit one of the Israeli jets and shot down several of the missiles. In a statement, the army said the Syrian air defense confronted the early morning attacks on military outposts in the area of Kutaifa in the Damascus countryside. The statement said several missiles were first launched from Lebanese airspace this morning, followed by 2 ground-to-ground missiles that were launched from the occupied Golan Heights, and 4 missiles later launched from the Tiberias region of the Sea of Galilee in northern Israel. The military said the attacks caused material damage. The Israeli military declined to comment on the matter. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said his government's policy of preventing weapons shipments from Syria to the militant group Hezbollah hasn't changed. An Iranian reformist lawmaker said today that some 3,700 people were arrested in the days of protests and unrest that roiled Iran over the past 2 weeks. Offering a far higher number than authorities previously released. The protest, which vented anger at high unemployment and official corruption, were the largest seen in Iran since the disputed 2009 presidential election, and some demonstrators called for the overthrow of the government. At least 21 people have been killed in the unrest surrounding the protests. Former state senator Mark Leno has entered the San Francisco mayor's race. Leno is expected to join a crowded field. Angela Alioto and Ellen Lee Zun have also declared their candidacies. Supervisor Jane Kim and Acting Mayor London Breed are also expected to file by today's deadline. They'll compete in a June special election to serve out the remainder of Ed Lee's term. Lee died unexpectedly last month. Christopher Martinez reports.
Many election watchers see the mayoral race as one that could shift politics away from a trend of more moderate mayors like Willie Brown, Gavin Newsom, and Ed Lee, and toward a more progressive mayor like Kim or Leno. Another possible candidate, City Attorney Dennis Herrera, has also filed and would be considered a more progressive candidate, but some think he may end up withdrawing his candidacy in the next few days.
It could end up being a 3-way race of 3 very prominent candidates who each bring different backgrounds and experiences, and so I think San Francisco should be very happy with the choice.
Randy Shaw is editor of the San Francisco news website Beyond Cron. He says the actual policy differences between the leading candidates is rather small.
You're going to have a race where where Jane will be like the most progressive candidate and Breed will be, I guess she'll bill herself as the continuation of where we've been, and Leno will try to get votes from both sides.
San Francisco voters will make their choice with a ranked choice ballot in the June special election. Reporting from San Francisco City Hall, I'm Christopher Martinez.
And I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. The Trump administration has been unrelentingly harsh in its immigration policy, with last year's Muslim ban, a massive border wall in the works, a growing deportation force, and hundreds of thousands of people in immigrant detention centers. And recently, Donald Trump has started an attack on humanitarian immigration, stripping protections away from immigrants who fled their home country after natural disasters or violence. Temporary Protection Status, or TPS, was put in place in 1990 under George Bush, and it's protected refugees from El Salvador, Haiti, Honduras, Nepal, Nicaragua, Somalia, Sudan, South Sudan, Syria, and Yemen, allowing them to safely build lives in the United States after crises like earthquakes or war. But in November, the Trump administration moved to end TPS status for roughly 2,500 Nicaraguans and close to 50,000 Haitians. And now on Monday, the Trump team announced it will end TPS status for roughly 200,000 Salvadorans who have lived in the United States, many for nearly two decades, and started families here, a number of children born in the United States. This community will need to leave the United States by September 2019 or be deported to El Salvador, a country many of them have not called home for several decades. And their U.S.-born children, well, what happens to them is in the balance. Salvadorans originally received TPS status in 2001 after two earthquakes devastated the region. Let us go now to a couple of short clips on one from MSNBC on Trump's announcement, and then another from AP of Salvadorans speaking out about the impact on their community.
200,000 Salvadorans, many who have lived in the U.S. since 2001, are being told that they have to leave the country by September 2019 or be deported. The Salvadorans were granted temporary protected status after earthquakes devastated that country 17 years ago, killing 1,000 people. Joining me now is NBC's national security and justice reporter Julia Ainsley. Julia, thanks so much. This follows similar orders against Hondurans and Haitians, but this is the largest group, 200,000 people who've been here for decades.
Yes, Andrea, and I think you and I talked about the time where they were focusing on the Hondurans, and we were predicting this move for the El Salvadorians. It's the largest population of people with temporary protected status living in the United States. Conservatives have said temporary protective status should only be reserved for people who are escaping some kind of natural disaster or other event that is temporary. And they say that these earthquakes that led them to come here have now, they've rebuilt from that. And so the earthquake is no longer the condition. However, a lot of immigration advocates would say still poverty and violence from gangs persist in El Salvador, and it is inhumane to send these people back at this point.
It's a lot of emotions. It's first of all, what's going to happen to my job, because that's, you know, my form of income. I've already gotten, you know, a couple of notifications from my employer saying, you know, your permit's about to expire. We just need a new copy. I'm also thinking about my parents and what's going to happen to them, because they're also under this status, and a lot of family members that are affected by this. So it's really heartbreaking, to say the least. You'd be surprised at the amount of people that are actually under this permit. And it's people like you and me who, you know, sit next to you, have families just like you, have dreams just like you.
This population was one of the populations that had been protecting their TPS for a long time. So the threat of deportation to them probably was minimal compared to someone who wasn't documented. But right now they're about to get thrown into the general population like everybody else. And worse for them, because the immigration already has all their details. They already know where they live, they already know where they work, they already know everything about them. So they're at bigger risk of getting deported than someone who probably is living in the shadows.
We have plans. We're going to fight back. Yeah, we already have legislation going on. And we're going to fight back. We are going to do everything we have to do to keep our legal status here in the United States.
I'm scared for this decision, yeah? TPS is my work, my health, and I have a problem with this.
And here to discuss all of this, I would like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth, Ángeles Zambrano. She has dedicated most of her life to the struggle for peace and justice, civil rights, and empowerment of immigrants in the Latino community. From 1995 to 2007, she served as the executive director of the Central American Resource Center, known as CARESEN, the largest Central American community center in the United States, serving more than 50,000 women, men, youth, and children annually with immigration, legal services, after-school programs, technology, civic participation, and a day labor center. Ángela is currently chair of CARESEN's board of directors and was named president emeritus of Alianza Americas, a national network of immigrant-led organizations. Ángela, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you, Margaret.
All right. Also on the line with us, we'd like to welcome Yanira Lemus, supervising attorney for the Loyola Immigrant Justice Clinic at Loyola Law School. As the daughter of Salvadoran immigrants, she has dedicated her legal career as an immigration attorney to represent the low-income and indigent immigrant community. Yanira, welcome.
Thank you so much, Margaret.
Okay, Ángela, let us just start with you. So much of your life dedicated to all of this. And tell us your view now on the impact on the Salvadoran community of this directive by Donald Trump.
I think that decision is cruel and inhumane because people with TPS, as it was noted earlier in the report, have made their lives in the United States already. I mean, they have had temporary protective status for about 17 years. And we're talking about 200,000, close to 200,000 people. And about many of these families have U.S. citizen children. Over 200,000 children, U.S. citizen children, have TPS, parents with TPS. So what is going to happen to these children? 80% of them, of the TPS recipients, are working, many own homes, they own businesses, they pay taxes, and help their families back home. So clearly, this is a political decision. It's a decision that is basically is based on anti-immigrant, xenophobic, racist policies that are designed to respond to the white supremacist agenda of the Trump administration. And that this is it is something that we have to fight. Tepecianos are fighting to get a permanent residence status in the United States.
Yeah, and Ángela, before we bring in our next guest here, the New York Times has an article, today's article, saying that employers are bracing for the loss of an immigrant workforce because we know the TPS status was also stripped from close to 60,000 Haitians and now so many people from El Salvador. And the New York Times is saying that these are people who are rebuilding Hurricane Houston, building in Atlanta, the new stadium building, helping with plumbing and heating systems at Fannie Mae's new headquarters, working at Disneyland, and that those with protected status work mainly in construction, restaurants, grocery stores, landscapers, and daycare workers. This according to data from El Salvador. Of course, we know that there are many who are also in the professional community, not only blue-collar jobs. But Ángela, just tell us then about the impact in states like California, and other states, that will be impacted by all this.
Right. Well, the economy, I mean, it, basically, the Trump administration received a lot of letters and support from both parties. They expressed the support for TPS because it was going to affect big businesses. Even the Chamber of Commerce sent a letter to President Trump. Church leaders, Catholic, from the Catholic Church, evangelists, unions, they have come together. In fact, unions and business have come together in support of the TPS. But see, neither the human cost or the economic consequences matter for the Trump administration because it is a political decision based on a white racist agenda.
Yeah, and Yanira Lemus, I'm bringing you into this discussion here, and you're the daughter of Salvadoran immigrants. You're also a lawyer, an attorney, and I'd like for you to share with our audience, for people who are in this situation, who are worried about loved ones, friends, and neighbors, to tell us what, if anything, they can do. But start out first by telling us about, what about these U.S.-born children? What will happen to them?
Well, their U.S.-born children are U.S. citizens, and depending on what the parents plan, what the parents are able to do for their children, they can stay in the United States, obviously.
But can their parents stay with them, or is this really about breaking up families?
In a lot of circumstances, it does lead to breaking up families because some parents might not have the ability to, or may not want to take their children to El Salvador. I have a lot of clients who are fleeing El Salvador because of the violence, because they are afraid for their lives, and people here know that. So someone, a parent, you know, I'm a parent, I wouldn't want to take my child to a country where I know from firsthand accounts that people are afraid to live in, and that's where they were born. That's where they have lived their entire lives. So unfortunately, yes, I think this is going to break up a lot of families.
So is there any legal way that parents who have U.S.-born children can stay? Or do they have to go if they came under the TPS jurisdiction?
I encourage everyone who has TPS, everyone who has no status or maybe just a temporary status, to get a legal consultation from an immigration attorney. It's really difficult to say for everyone if their U.S. citizen child can file a family petition on their behalf, but generally, someone who is over 21 can file a family petition for, and a U.S. citizen can file a family petition for their parent. However, everyone's situation is different. You know, TPS is, the Ninth Circuit held that TPS is an admission for immigration purposes, and that can be helpful to a lot of people because a lot of people sometimes are not able to become residents or adjust because they entered unlawfully. And this is, this could be an exception. So I encourage everyone to get a consultation. There is this possibility. If they have a U.S. citizen child who is over 21, there is the possibility that they will be able to adjust.
Yeah, and Angela, bringing you it back here into the discussion, I mean, I'm a mom, and any way you cut it, you know, it's good that there is some option if your child is over 21. But let's say you've got a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old or 10-year-old. You're a mom and you have, it sounds as though, no recourse. The choice is either you leave your child in the United States, hopefully with some loved ones, or you take them back to El Salvador, where we know so many children were fleeing El Salvador because of being, you know, forced into illegal activity or possibly being killed. This kind, I mean, this is unbelievably heartless from people, conservatives who claim that they stand for family values. Angela, just your response on what is happening with the children.
Right. I think that is the most critical situation. I'm talking a lot with parents who have children, small children still in school, high school or elementary school. And many of them are looking at doing the caretaker's kind of legal document that would allow a relative or a friend to keep the child here in the United States in the event that they get deported. But many of them are saying that they're just not going back. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that we're going to see a lot of people that are going to go underground again. They don't want to go back. They'd rather stay here and be, feel like you're under persecution constantly than going back and possibly facing death for the children. So the choices are horrible. They're terrible. They're not good choices. The only alternative, and this is actually what is making people organize, a lot of we call them Tepecianos, people that have TPS protection right now, they are organizing into a national TPS alliance, and they are working to try to get a permanent residence legislation in Congress, because that's the only choice they have. But people are fighting back, but the children and the families are facing a terrible, horrible situation.
Right. Yanira, I'll go back to you. But Angela, one of the things of concern is that we know that for parents who, let's say, were deported and have U.S.-born children, that sometimes these children are actually placed in foster care with strangers and then perhaps even put up for adoption. And I've heard horrific stories of children who were then cut off from their mothers, who may be in Mexico or, you know, wherever they were deported to, because the adoptive family or whatever didn't want them to continue that kind of relationship. And so phone calls and that sort of thing was cut off. So this is another kind of hidden aspect of what is happening here. So, Angela, I just wanted to get your reaction to that. And also, I had heard that some people were literally forming a new underground railroad, including some churches and perhaps even families that whose heart goes out and who are providing some, really, I hate to put it this way, but some form of refuge so that families and children can stay together. A reaction from you and then Yanira.
Yes. Well, what happens if the parents get arrested and they are put in deportation proceedings and deported, and they don't have a caretaker's document that specifies who can take care of the children? The state will take their children and put them in foster homes. Mm. And then it becomes a nightmare, even for people that are U.S. citizens. Once their children enter the foster care system assigned by the state, it's really difficult to get your children back. So imagine a parent that is outside of the country. I mean, it's like it's almost impossible, and that's where, in terms of the Underground Railroad concept, that's where the sanctuary movement comes in, and a lot of churches are now offering sanctuary for families that may be facing the deportation situation. But imagine when you have 200,000 people.
Yeah.
You're talking about a lot, and the majority, I would say like maybe almost 50% of are here in California. So that's why we need to strengthen our solidarity, the work with the churches, the unions, and the community-based organizations like Carecen is going to be critical. And, of course, the people themselves to organize and to push back and to protect the children. That is really critical that the parents find out how they can protect their children from going into a possible foster family situation.
Yeah, and Yanira Lemus, who's a supervising attorney for Loyola Immigrant Justice Clinic at Loyola Law School. Just some final thoughts here from you. One on this thing about protecting the children. For parents who may be listening to this right now and who likely are very, very freaked out about what's happening, but also outline again any steps that people who are in this situation should take.
Yeah, well, I think it's really important for people who fear any, have any fear of deportation to create a family preparedness plan. There are organizations, nonprofits that help families do this, like Betsedic, for example. And they also have presentations at different community centers to inform people on the process of how to do this. Essentially, it lays out a plan of, you know, a legal plan for their children in case they're not able to care for them, like if they're placed in detention or in removal proceedings. And it's important for people to remember the dates, I think, that the Department of Homeland Security stated that in 18 months, so on September 9th, 2019, TPS for Salvadorans will end, and they will issue the re-registration date at a later date. So the re-registration date or time frame isn't available yet, but people should be aware that that's going to be announced. And when it finally is announced, all the forms necessary to re-register are available on the USCIS website for free. They have to fill out the I-821, the application for temporary protected status, and possibly the form I-765, the application for employment authorization to have proof that their work permit is still valid. And these forms are available for free. However, people have to pay to have these forms processed and to have their fingerprints taken. And if someone can't afford to have to pay this fee, there is a fee waiver available. The application is also available on the USCIS website for free. They have to qualify. However, if they can't afford to pay the fees, it's possible that they qualify, whether it's because of their income or because they receive some mean-tested benefit or another like extraordinary circumstance.
Yeah, so I imagine because we really are out of time, although we want to continue to cover this, just Yanira, can people contact the Loyola Immigrant Justice Clinic to get some help in these areas?
Yes, I encourage them to come to one of our biweekly consultations. We will post more information on our Instagram and Facebook. Or you can email lijc@lls.edu and we'll go ahead and reply with our consultation information. You know, we can, we take certain cases also free. We're able to take, you know, a limited number of cases. Unfortunately, there are not that many attorneys on staff. However, we are very, eager to help. So please come to the consultations.
Right. And, Yanira, if you will send us that information, we will definitely post it on our social media website, et cetera, so our audience would be able to have access to that information. We're going to have to leave it there. But Angela Sembrano, thank you so very much for your decades of work and for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Margaret.
Thank you.
And thank you for informing us, the community.
All right. And thank you, Yanira Lemus, Supervising Attorney for the Loyola Immigrant Justice Clinic at Loyola Law School. Thank you for joining us. And again, send us that information so we can post it. Okay. We are going to take a short station break. And coming up, Kumi Naidu on the line with us. He is the launch director of Africans Rising. There's a lot going on the continent right now, from Libya to Kenya to Zimbabwe and more. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
People moving out, people moving in. Why? Because of the color of the skin.
Run, 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 but you sure can't hide.
And I, boy, and I, a tooth for a tooth. Vote for me and I'll set you free. Rap on, brother, rap on. Well, the only person talking about love.
And the song Ball of Confusion by the great Temptations. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety. And you can check us out on our website at www.sotrueradio.org. We also keep a calendar of events that our listeners might be interested in. And if you're a member of Facebook, please like and friend us on Facebook. All of our back shows are also archived on our website. And we are also found on SoundCloud. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And today we want to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners on the continent of Africa. We're looking into it. We actually found that one of the highest percentage of SoundCloud listeners in Sojourner Truth are in South Africa. Who would know this? So we welcome all of our international listeners. There are thousands of them tuning into Sojourner Truth. And we also want to give a shout out to people who are incarcerated. We are getting letters from people who are incarcerated in California, in New York, and other places that some way, somehow seem to have access to this show as well. And we would like to give a shout out to them. We are now going to welcome back to Sojourner Truth Kumi Naidu. And before I bring Kumi on the line, we're going to be focusing on what is happening. We can't focus on everything because the continent of Africa is huge. The largest numbers of individual nations of any continent on the planet. So we'll get through what we can. But first, we wanted to just share with you something that some of our listeners have asked about, and the growing controversy about the slave trade in Libya. Let's go to that clip now.
An ongoing civil war in Libya is fueling chaos, despair, and a devastating migrant crisis. People trying to flee Africa for Europe are getting trapped in Libya, where they are facing brutal conditions like slavery, murder, beatings, torture, and rape.
Now, the European Union is working with the Libyan Coast Guard to reduce the number of migrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea, but many end up in detention centers. BBC News correspondent Stephanie Hegarty spoke with some survivors who just returned home to Nigeria.
Many of those who've walked the streets of Benin have dreamed of going to Europe. Jackson and Felix almost made it. But they were arrested in a boat off the coast of Libya and sent to prison in a place called Geryon.
Before they sent me as a slave in the prison, I witnessed close to 10 deaths. The Mudida used to guard us, which is the Arab woman. He came at the night, he now count 20 of us.
Take us to the farm. I work for a farm. I harvest onions. We work. No food. Sometimes
they said when they were no longer needed, they were dumped in the desert, rescued by a man driving by. They were repatriated to Nigeria with the help of the UN. We spoke to several Nigerian migrants, cross-checking the details of their stories, and each told us of the same horrifying trend. Prison authorities leasing or selling migrants to local businesses as labour. It's a new development in a dark and brutal industry in which traffickers and prison guards extort migrants, forcing them to buy their freedom.
And that clip is from CBS News. So let's welcome back to Sojourner Truth Kumi Naidu, South African human rights activist, prominent anti-apartheid campaigner. He currently serves as the launch director of Africans Rising and was formerly the international executive director of Greenpeace. Kumi, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Margaret, and Happy New Year to your listeners.
And to you. And Kumi, there is, speaking of Happy New Year, I was just reading an article about some studies that were done and found that people on the continent, on the happiness scale, tend to be very hopeful, right? And people were trying to figure out what was behind that. And one of the things they referred to was just the cultural thing that I think is likely across the continent and has in the African diaspora, of a kind of a more collectivity and people taking responsibility for each other. But that is in contrast then to all of the people who are then fleeing, going to Libya and being exploited in this way. I don't want to just entirely focus on that, because so much of Africa, we talk about victims as opposed to actually what's happening. But just any brief comments from you on the situation in Libya and the what is called the modern-day slave trade happening?
Well, the situation in Libya has revealed a bigger problem of people trafficking on the African continent. It is a testimony of failure of the African Union and several nation states on the continent. I think the media exposés that brought this to light must be commended. But I think what we are seeing is that as the continent moves in a direction of shrinking resources and more people, what the climate scientists warn us against, which is that as our water sources, our land resources, and therefore food become constrained, that in fact we will see more conflict and we'll see migration that will be added on to economic migration as well as people fleeing political persecution. However, my optimism for the continent comes from a few places. One is the deep cultural power, as you mentioned, of the peoples of Africa and how people actually can draw on cultural heritage, complicated as though that might be. But secondly, right now, I think what is empowering and emboldening people and giving people a sense of optimism is that things have got to a rock bottom low for so many people in so many countries on the continent, from Togo to Cameroon to Zimbabwe and more, that we are seeing new forms of political organizing and mobilizing. The very creation of Africans Rising for Justice, Peace and Dignity, a more decentralized Pan-African movement, is one such expression. And I think that also what we are seeing is that, you know, in the past we had very centralized ways of organizing, and now when we look at some of the most powerful forms of mobilization that we are seeing, whether it's Yanama, which is in Senegal fighting corruption, a combination of conventional NGO activists and cultural activists coming together, whether it's Enough is Enough in Nigeria, whether it was His Fees Must Fall in South Africa. All of these movements are actually driven by a very different kind of organizing mentality. It's much more decentralized. It's much more leaderful. When I say leaderful, I mean, you know, one of the big problems we have on the continent is we are still stuck with the big man syndrome, and we need to be building movements and pathways for fighting for justice, which does not replicate what we see happening at the governmental level. And there is, even though things are difficult, if you look at the situation in Togo, where we've had the dynasty political leadership for almost 40 years, people are standing up and people are paying with their lives and so on. And while repression is a big, big factor in terms of activism, I think there's a sense from many people on the continent, enough is enough and no more. We refuse to accept that this is the best realities we can create for our people on the continent. And I think there's also a growing sense that individual African countries are not going to be able to make it on their own towards a better society. We need to have a spirit of Pan-Africanism where people across the continent can actually find common ground and support each other in much more powerful ways than we've done in the past.
Yeah, and underscoring that point in two ways, I see in courts and some other places, you know, a debate more among the mainstream. Should other countries on the continent follow the formula that Kangabe has done in Rwanda, right, where there is human rights violations, etc. But they're saying, well, you know, some people have been lifted out of poverty. So there is that. And from, what we all know, that kind of thing can be bankrupt in terms of looking at that as any solution. And I just returned home from my home country of Barbados in the Caribbean and had some meetings there where there was a discussion about the call for reparations, reparatory justice for those of us in the diaspora, so to speak, for not only people of African descent, but people of indigenous descent. And there was some controversy because in the lead up to a major conference that happened, I think it was in South Africa, on the UN decade for people of African descent, there was a lot of support from representatives of governments on the continent standing with people in the diaspora putting forward this demand. But then at the last minute, the big men, as you call it, the heads of state of some of these countries came in and really scuttled a lot of the preparatory work that had been done, where people in the diaspora were so hopeful of this kind of collaboration of countries on the continent. So that kind of thing not only impacts, as you say, what is happening on the continent, but also spreads throughout the diaspora, with that being an example. Any comments from you on this, Kumi?
Absolutely. I mean, firstly, to put faith in African heads of state to take on an issue in a fundamental way like reparations for slavery, I would argue is a very, very risky bet. I could have said that right at the outset, because far too many of our governments are in the pockets of certain dominant countries in the world because of aid dependency, right? And so, if you take how the Trump administration played the vote on Palestine recently on the question of the Israeli embassy in Jerusalem, you know, they did something very honest that previous U.S. administrations have always done, but the Trump administration was honest, maybe not intentionally so, but they ended up being much more honest by saying, hey, you know, we are giving you money, and we can squeeze that money, and we can shut that out, so we will be taking names, they said. Now, I can tell you that in many negotiations, whether it's climate negotiations, trade negotiations, and so on, this kind of corrupting influence of dominant countries, the United States being one of them, other Western nations as well, that try to influence the positions that are taken, and people get bought out by, you know, either proper aid packages or by various types of corruption.
Yeah.
And just I want to say something about corruption. You know, you'll hear certain political leaders in the so-called developed countries will say, you know, how they're opposed to corruption and how big a problem corruption is in Africa and other places in the South. Now, let me just say that corruption is a really, really big problem that we have to address. But I want to be very clear. When you are talking about the big-scale corruption, whether it is, you know, where tons, billions of money of dollars are taken out of the continent, none of that, which is mainly in the extractive industries, you know, oil, coal, gas, diamonds, and so on, none of those corruptive activities would be possible by African elites, made not for the involvement, collusion, participation, and complicity of very, very powerful Western interests. And now, increasingly, also China is in play. So let's be very clear that part of what we are dealing with on the continent, even when we look at conflict and war and the spread of weaponry and so on, we are still very much a victim of Western colonial design. While we say to our governments, you cannot blame every single thing that you're doing on that historical legacy and how that plays out in the present, and it's not fair to do that, but equally it's not fair to actually say that it's not a factor anymore. It is still a big factor of how the complicity and collusion of very powerful governments who preach democracy on the one hand, but undermine it left, right, and center on the other.
Yeah, and Kumi, just the few minutes we have left here, I did want to touch on Zimbabwe and Kenya before you go, because we know in Zimbabwe, Mugabe is out. There was fundamentally a military coup that many people, though, celebrated. And I was just looking at an article. I can't find it in front of me right now, but I did read it pretty thoroughly, where a white farmer who had his land taken, his farm taken in the land redistribution under Mugabe, triumphantly returned an escort by the military escort by the new government of Zimbabwe. And I suppose for people looking at that article, that's just one aspect of it, but it, you know, I'm sure cause some concern about what are the intentions of this new government, because we know that the land had been so much controlled by the majority white farmers, but we also know that there were a lot of problems with the redistribution that Mugabe was putting in place. Just break that down a little for us.
So firstly, the agenda of land distribution is a fundamentally just and ethical issue. However, when you look at Robert Mugabe's performance and who benefited from his land distribution, it was done on the basis of cronyism and corruption, where the top elites in Zimbabwe took a majority of the best land for themselves.
Right.
Secondly, there was no real support to ensure that new emerging small black farmers, family farms, and so on would be given the right kind of support to succeed. So what you had was a land redistribution that was chaotic, corrupt, and so on, and not then supported, so that also led to a food crisis and all that we have seen. So, but it's very important that your listeners realize that while it's a good thing that President Mugabe has left power after more than 30 years, it's a really troubling thing that he has sewn up for himself a whole range of benefits and guarantees and so on. And secondly, that his successor, President Mnangagwa, has been complicit in every human rights atrocity that President Mugabe engaged in. So I think it's very important, while we look at what's happening in Zimbabwe as opening up possibilities for new forms of political organizing and new parties and so on, the current status quo from President Mugabe to President Mnangagwa does not give us too much cause for optimism. The second thing I would just say, if we look at South Africa, which also had a rather seismic event in the ANC elections
that
took place in December. And again, while Cyril Ramaphosa, the new elected president of the ANC, came on an anti-corruption ticket and so on, and he is not beyond reproach because he has complicity in the Marikana massacre and so on. What we see in South Africa is the power of citizen mobilization, because the ANC was treating the majority of the people as voting fodder, and now they've got the message that they either clean up the mess of corruption and self-serving political leadership, otherwise they now run the serious risk of being voted out in power in 2019. So there are sparks of optimism, but it's sad that some of the things that we are getting optimistic about are things that we thought we should have taken care of it quite a long time ago. But so long as I think we create more spaces, especially for young people, to be able to take leadership roles and so on, and not see young people as the leaders of tomorrow, but see them as leaders of tomorrow, because of today. Because quite frankly, if you're brutally blunt, the current generation of adult political leadership has run out of fresh ideas. And the best thing they can do is actually step aside, create the possibilities for new visionary thinking, and that's not going to come from people who are very vested in a system that has not really worked for the majority of us.
Kumi, I'm afraid we are out of time, so we're going to have to leave it there. But Kumi, I hope your schedule will allow you to be back perhaps next week, because there's more to what's going on in South Africa. I'd like to dig more into that. And Kenya, which we did not get to, and also Congo. So we'll be in touch with you so we can continue this conversation. Great. Thank you.
I'll be happy to join you again. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Kumi Naidu. We are out of time. Today's show produced by me, myself, Margaret Prescott. And I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team, our intern, Sherelle Withers. Sherelle, welcome back. We missed you. And also our assistant producer, Stephanie Case, our engineer, Mr. T, Teddy Robinson. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. Go online to Pacifica Radio Archives.org. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And here's what we have coming up for you for the remainder of the morning here at KBOO. At the top of the hour, it's Press Watch. Today, Teresa Mitchell says it's Nixon time again. She'll discuss the Mueller probe. But I think first she's going to drill down to some truth about Walmart. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, David Naiman talks to author Leni Zumas about her provocative new novel, Red Clocks. It's a drama that deals with reproductive rights, motherhood, and freedom. And then at 11:30, Words and Pictures, iconic cartoonist Tom Gauld, who's known for his work in The New Yorker and The Guardian, talks about his graphic novels, Parenthood and Dystopias. And again, we remind you that KBOO is keeping you informed with all kinds of truth. And you can get involved by going to kboo.fm and click where it says donate, and you can join us by becoming a member, and that would be fantastic. We have one announcement before we get to Press Watch. Thanks for tuning in this morning.
KBOO hosts a monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater called KBOO at the Clinton. This month, we'll screen the film This Changes Everything on Thursday, January 11th at 7 p.m. Filmed over 211 shoot days in 9 countries and 5 continents over 4 years, This Changes Everything is an attempt to reimagine the vast challenge of climate change. The film is narrated by Naomi Klein and presents 7 portraits of communities on the front lines, from Montana to South India to Beijing and beyond. Again, that's a film screening of This Changes Everything, Thursday, January 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland.